This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast, featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, October the 6th on CBC Radio. With the fighting ongoing in Gaza and Lebanon, first up, we'll bring you the latest from the Middle East. Then, on this eve of the one-year anniversary of the Hamas attack on Israel, two people affected by October 7th and the ensuing war in Israel and in Gaza will share their experiences of the last year and where they're at now. Plus, we'll explore what the future may hold for both Israel and Hamas. Elsewhere today, Canadian NHLer Nazem Kadri on the pride and prejudice that comes with being the first Muslim player to win the Stanley Cup. And from Donald Trump's suits to Tim Walz's camo caps, we'll hear what clothes communicate on the campaign trail. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. The Hamas attack on Israel last October was the start of a very bloody period of warfare in a region that has seen more than its share of conflict over the years. And the violence in the region continues to escalate. The CBC's Chris Brown has spent much of the past year in Israel and the occupied West Bank covering the conflict. Chris is in Jerusalem today. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
What's the mood and atmosphere in Israel on the eve of last year's attack?
Well, I would say apprehension, a sense that as really bad as things have been, as unstable, it could get worse and even much worse. You know, as we're talking, there's a mass casualty event that that's unfolding in Beersheba. People dead, many people injured. It's the second one in just a few days here. So there's that, but there's also really waiting for Israel's response to the Iran missile strikes of the other night. We're seeing lots of warnings foreshadowing that it's very close, Iranian airspace closed, tankers moved away from docks, and all of this creates a great sense of apprehension and fear. But it's, you know, I don't have to tell you, it's a very complicated place. Israelis talk about the trauma of October the 7th, not just from the massacres, but because of how it shattered their sense of security, how the military and intelligence services failed, how their prime minister Netanyahu personally failed. And as awful as the events have been in Gaza, you know, people are just feeling very, very insecure. And only in the last, I would say, since they've begun the operation in Lebanon, have Israelis begun to change their feelings on this. So we have a lot of contradictory emotions, I think. Fear, anxiety, weariness, it's all kind of mixed in there.
Understandable. 1,200 Israelis were killed, 250 taken hostage. About 100 hostages are still being held in Gaza. And we'll get to Gaza in a bit. But how is Israel planning to mark this tragic anniversary tomorrow?
Well, that too, very complicated. How the government is planning to mark it and how a lot of Israelis are planning to mark it are really two different things. There's an official pre-recorded memorial service that's been set up by the government. There's no audience there. That's going to be televised. But a lot of the Gaza border communities, the kibbutzes that were so horribly wounded by this attack a year ago, they're not taking part in this. Their position on it is that the government is trying to avoid responsibility for the role it played in failing to prevent these massacres. So other people are organizing alternate ceremonies in Tel Aviv. We were at a kibbutz Be'eri just the day before yesterday. 102 people were killed there. And they told us their plan is going to be to go to the cemetery where victims were buried. I didn't even realize this, that a lot of victims, of course, weren't able to be buried where they died in their communities. because it wasn't safe. So they were buried elsewhere, and now they're being reburied. So you have these second funerals in many cases, up to 5 a week in Barrie. And so that's going to be going on as well. And then there's the Nova Music Festival. There's going to be a special ceremony there in the morning. Music's going to stop at 6:29, exactly when it stopped a year ago. And then there's siren, a minute of silence, and a mass prayer. So that just gives you a sense of some of the events.
It's also been a very dire year in Gaza. According to the Gaza Ministry of Health, more than 41,000 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been killed, 96,000 injured. What are you hearing about how Palestinians may be marking the day tomorrow?
Well, I think a lot of the Palestinians in Gaza that we've been talking to through our videographer and through phone calls and other conversations, they feel abandoned. They think the situation's very hopeless. One of the things I'm struck by is just the absence of really any kind of long-term thinking. The focus just is about basic tasks: finding food, finding water, moving around in a way that they can stay alive and avoid rockets. So this all adds up, I think, to a struggle of survival. And one of the interviews that really struck me was with an English-speaking medical student. It was really heartbreaking. He just said his life went from studying medicine, his dream of becoming a doctor, to this just daily grind of looking for food and water. He said, I was full of hope, but this year I had to burn it with my own hands, because if I didn't do that, the Israeli rockets would destroy me. So this is, I think, a universal feeling. I also feel it when you go to the West Bank. Obviously, the violence is on a very different level there, different issues. But just this sense of hopelessness, I think, is very pervasive.
And Chris, as you said, mentioned the occupied West Bank. You've spent a lot of time there this past year. Israel hasn't allowed journalists into Gaza, save for the few occasions where they've been allowed to go in with the Israeli military. And so you've really only had access to part of the Palestinian territories. And as you mentioned, there has been violence in the West Bank as well. Are there efforts being made there to tamp down the violence as this broader conflict really escalates?
So if you're talking about settler violence by extremist Jewish groups against Palestinians, against farmers and so forth, there haven't been, I would say, that much in the way of efforts to tap it down. A lot of the people that are engaged in this, they see the area, first of all, not as the occupied West Bank, but as Judea Samaria. They believe that the Jewish community has an ancient right to this land, and this is in part what's going on. They're pushing in, and there are many ministers in Netanyahu's government that are actively encouraging it. And the war in Gaza, I think, is providing a lot of cover for that. Some of the rights groups, like B'Tselem, will say, only like 3% of cases are people ever prosecuted, Israeli settlers ever prosecuted for the crimes they commit against Palestinians. And I mean, over the last year, I've talked to many, been to many sites where settler mobs have just come and tried to torch people's homes and steal their sheep and push them off the land. And so what you're seeing, in Lebanon and Gaza is a very, very different kind of conflict. There, it's more of a, let's say, a slice by slice, gradual kind of clashes.
Yeah. Let's talk about Lebanon. Israel assassinated Hezbollah's longtime leader, Hassan Nasrallah, just 10 days ago. And I use the word just because so much has happened in the last 10 days. As the Israeli military continues to pound Lebanon with airstrikes, ground troops are fighting in the southern part of the country. The Israeli Prime Minister says all this is an effort to get the Israelis who have not been able to return to the northern part of Israel since October 7th because of Hezbollah rocket attacks, to get them back home. But just to give some context, in just the past couple of weeks, 1,400 people in Lebanon have been killed. More than 1 million people are displaced. How are people in Lebanon coping, Chris?
I think this is something that we're just slowly being exposed to. While in Gaza, it's very difficult to get down there for foreign journalists, because, of course, the whole border is sealed. It's not that much different in southern Lebanon. International media have been stopped largely by Hezbollah, also because It's just an extremely, violent place. It's very dangerous to go. Last night, some of the absolute worst airstrikes that we've seen of this conflict rocked that entire area. So this is not known. This ground invasion started about 1 week ago. Israel has said it was going to be, first of all, they didn't even call it an invasion. They call it an incursion, pinpoint operations, and on a limited scale. But what is that limit? Is it limited by time? Is it limited by distance going across the border? Much of that we really don't know. It certainly doesn't appear to be limited by the amount of ammunition that's being expended, dropping from the sky and so forth on these positions. The Israeli military says about 440 Hezbollah fighters have been killed. We know that less than a dozen, I think around 10 Israeli soldiers have been killed, but dozens more injured. And we also know the last time that Israel went in 2006, Hezbollah essentially fought the IDF to a standstill. So this is a very, very difficult fight for Israel, even though they've managed these tactical successes very early on with the pager explosions, with the walkie-talkie explosions, taking out Hassan Nasrallah. We're only really seeing the very first chapter in this.
And then, of course, there's Iran. Israel says it will respond at its time and place and way of choosing to the Iran ballistic missiles that were fired at Israel. And Israel says it's going to retaliate with significant force. The big question, of course, is what might that response look like? Do we have any sense, Chris, do you, of what and when it might be?
Well, when it might be is soon. I think we say that because certainly there's a lot of messaging behind the scenes, statements from the Israeli government. Also, as I say, actions by the Iranian government, moving its oil tankers out to sea, closing its airspace, putting its military on high alert. All of that suggests that these two adversaries are gearing up for something soon, possibly even within the next 48 hours. And as for what's it going to be, well, that really is the question. Iran fired about 180 missiles at Israel the other night. Most of them, as far as we can tell, were aimed at military targets, and most of them were shot down by the Iron Dome and other anti-missile defenses. But, 32 got through. 32 got through and hit around an air base. They hit near the Mossad building. So there's lots of potential takeaways you can get from this. One, I think, the Israeli message is that no damage was caused. We kind of won. It was an embarrassment for Iran. On the other hand, 32 missiles getting through is very, very significant and could have done a great deal of damage had they gotten through, for example, to a heavily populated area. So, will Israel strike at oil facilities? Will they, strike at the nuclear facilities that Iran has? These are the key questions. And Iran has said they're going to do a near immediate response as well. So the stakes could not be higher.
And with all of this, world leaders are just struggling to contain this growing conflict. There have been strong words of condemnation and words to everyone to take a breath. U.S. President Joe Biden has urged Israel to respond to Iran proportionally. There has been a lot of talk about tamping down the violence. Words are one thing, Chris. Do you think the world community, if I can call it that, that isn't even, in full cohesion, but does it matter what they say at this point? Like, do you see this violence tamping down in any way?
Well, we don't know ever really what is said privately, say, between Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu. We know publicly the Americans urged the Israelis to get a ceasefire with Hamas. And after that, there were accusations that Benjamin Netanyahu added more conditions, even as the Americans also blamed Hamas. We know the Americans said, don't go into Rafah. Israel flattened Rafah. Don't invade Lebanon. Israel went into Lebanon. So we know that Benjamin Netanyahu is really driven by his own political calculations, not Joe Biden's. And that is satisfying the far right elements in his government that are pushing for more aggression to lock in all of these tactical gains, if you will, that they've made against, for example, Hezbollah by pushing the war in Lebanon. And also Netanyahu's own desire to keep his government in power, avoid an election, and, of course, to keep himself out of jail because he's up on all kinds of corruption charges. And if he's not the prime minister, well, then all of that suddenly comes into play.
Mm. Chris, you've been covering this conflict on the ground for a year now, while covering many other stories, I should add. And I'm just wondering, as you have a moment, if you do, today and tomorrow to reflect on the past year, what are you thinking about?
I think what I find so absolutely difficult to process is just the polarity that you see here from both sides. I've talked to many Palestinians who don't believe there were any atrocities committed on October the 7th, that it was all against military targets, or that what was said afterwards was made up, you know, to kind of justify the bombing of Gaza. But I've also talked to a great many Israelis who don't believe that 41,000 people were killed in Gaza, or if they were, they were all terrorists, or if they were, it actually doesn't matter. So this is an absolutely immense, very depressing gap. And the number of people who are speaking about ways to try to bridge that, it's just not very many here, really.
Hmm. Take good care. Thanks for all the work you've been doing, and please stay safe.
Thanks.
Chris Brown is a CBC correspondent. We reached him today in Jerusalem. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. This is the Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio and streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play, wherever you are. Nazem Kadri recalls his childhood days in his favorite place doing his favorite thing. His favorite place, Victoria Park in London, Ontario. His favorite thing, skating with his dad, Samir. Samir was convinced his little boy would one day graduate to the big hockey league. And boy, oh boy, was he ever right. Nazem not only made it to the NHL, he also became the first player who is Muslim to win the Stanley Cup. From his NHL start with the Toronto Maple Leafs and his championship run with the Colorado Avalanche to now playing center for the Calgary Flames, Nazem's identity, his staunch confidence, and yes, his scuffles have defined him on and off the ice. Nazem is telling his life story in a memoir. It's called Dreamer, My Life on the Edge. Nazem Kadri, hi, happy birthday.
Yeah, thanks guys. Thank you for having me.
Let's go back to London, Ontario some 30 years ago. What was it about hockey that hooked you as a little guy?
I feel like my initial, you know, love of the game probably came from outside, and just you know, that's kind of what attracted me. And you know, being with friends and you know, skating on ice and grabbing a cup of hot chocolate after, and those were probably my fondest memories, and you know, ones I'll certainly never forget.
Yeah, you know, parents stand by their kids. They support them. That's what they do. And lots of parents are like, yeah, my kid's good at whatever the thing is that they're doing. Maybe they'll make it to the big leagues one day. Maybe they won't. But your dad, Samir Nazem, the way you tell it, your dad was like, 100% my kid's going to the NHL. I know that. And you write a lot about your dad and your grandfather, both of whom immigrated to Canada from Lebanon, in shaping who you are. Tell me about your dad and your grandfather. How did they influence you in those early days?
Yeah, I mean, certainly my dad was, he's an ambitious guy and, you know, is certainly dedicated to anything he does. So, you know, he first introduced me to the game and taught me, you know, how to skate and how to shoot and how to play. And my grandfather didn't really know much about it, but he was more of just a working class, blue collared guy, just always had that, you know, an immense amount of work ethic to provide for his family. And my father, on the other hand, was the big hockey fan. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I don't have really any historical background when it comes to anybody playing the game of hockey. In fact, like zero. So I was pretty much the only person that had played organized hockey throughout my family and, you know, was lucky enough to pave a nice path to professional hockey.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, he never laced up a pair of skates. He never held a stick in your hand. And yet you say, look, when I was a kid, the person that was teaching me how to play hockey was my pa.
Well, yeah, which is pretty remarkable. I mean, sometimes I ask myself the same question. And, you know, he certainly does impress me at times with how much he knows about the game for having, you know, no really experienced playing the game. He's certainly an impressive person, and you know, I guess it rubbed off on me a little.
The other thing is that your family, your sisters, your mom, your big Lebanese Canadian family used to go watch you play hockey from a very young age. No matter where you were, there were the cadres in the stands, having their own cheering section over there. And I bring that up because you have a very supportive family, and they've supported you through the good things and the bad things. And I want to talk about some of the challenges, especially when you're a kid. You know, you're a brown kid playing hockey from an immigrant family. And when you're about 10, you began to face some of the things that I think your father, your grandfather had faced in their own ways. But you got it from the stands where you experienced racism on the ice. What do you remember about those incidents and what your family told you to do when those kinds of things happen?
It was awkward, to say the least, for sure. It kind of made me feel obviously very uncomfortable. I just, at a young age, you can't really put two and two together when things like that happen. But some vulgar, you know, disgusting behavior from grownups, and as a matter of fact, which is, you know, makes it a whole lot worse. But, you know, as a kid, I just tried to continue to work. And I always was the type of person to, you know, want to prove doubters wrong. And, you know, luckily for me, I think I had a very supportive family. They, you know, were able to help me navigate it.
And so, Nazem, when you look back on it now as a grown adult, how did those experiences inform how you approached, I mean, just walking in this world and in your sport as a Canadian, but as a Canadian who is a brown Muslim man?
It has its challenges, especially when it's, you know, happens more times than you'd want it to. As a young kid, you feel insecure about it. You feel lots of doubt. You know, it's hard to overcome at first. And that's when you need your family to lean on. And thankfully, I had that. But, you know, after that initial feeling and you learn how to deal with it, I think it, you know, there becomes a little bit of a hatred there and a little bit of a chip on your shoulder. And it kind of fuels the fire a little bit. And, you know, that's kind of where your kind of ruthless mindset kicks in and you do anything to survive.
So through all this, you're playing hockey, you know, playing in the OHL, you're playing for the London Knights, for Kitchener, you're playing in the juniors. And then in 2009, you did exactly what your father knew you would do. You get drafted by the Leafs. He didn't think it would be the Leafs or didn't want it to be the Leafs as a Habs fan, but you make the NHL. And it takes you a couple of years to find your footing. And when you walk into the NHL, Nazem, you express like a huge amount of confidence. Where does that come from for you?
Probably my dad. I mean, he's a pretty confident individual himself. You know what? One thing he always told me was that had stuck with me. You know, if you don't believe in yourself, you know, how can you expect anybody else to? So I think that was a slogan that kind of stuck with me for a long time. And in professional sports, there's a lot of time to doubt yourself and have a real negative mindset. But at the end of the day, it can be easier said than done, but you know, you need that confidence and to go anywhere.
Your air of confidence was well-earned. Your goal-scoring rose. You became an integral part of the team. But some critics have called it cockiness. And you write in your book, quote, "When I came into the league, my confidence was viewed as a character flaw, but I knew it was one of my most valuable weapons." So where do you see the line between those two things, confidence and cockiness?
Well, there certainly is a balance. You know, as just a younger person, you feel more invincible than you should, you know, and as you kind of mature, you start to understand how to deal with that. I think I came into the NHL at a bit of a transition phase where, you know, you kind of had to prove your worth, which I was okay with, but you had to do it in a quiet fashion. You had to have like a quiet confidence and not ruffle anybody's feathers. So I took a bit of a different approach, and it may have rubbed some people the wrong way, but you know, in the end, once they got to know me, they understood, you know, I was a guy they'd want to have on their team.
And do you think part of that was, I don't know, like a different approach, kind of challenging the culture, the character of the game?
I think so, because, you know, hockey is very traditional. And, you know, I think the sport needed, you know, some personality and some confidence and some swagger. And obviously, you know, I'm not by all means saying I did every single thing correctly, because I certainly made a lot of mistakes on the way. But it's a traditional game, and everybody expects you to, I mean, at least back then, they'd expect you to kind of fall in line and be quiet about it. But I believed in myself, and it took a little while for everyone else to believe in me as well.
Let's talk about some of those mistakes. With the Leafs, you racked up a string of suspensions for illegal cross checks and elbow to the head. There's others. You're fined $200,000 as a repeat offender. Then you get traded to the Colorado Avalanche in 2019. And then during the playoff run in 2021, you get suspended 8 games for an illegal hit to the head against defenseman Justin Falk from the St. Louis Blues. Colorado is eliminated before you could get back on the ice. So you just said, you know, I made my share of mistakes. Looking back, do you have any regrets about your on-ice conduct?
Of course. I wish I was on the ice and playing instead of in the press box watching. But none of those things were meant to be malicious. In fact, a lot of times, you know, I was standing up for teammates and trying to rally with my teammates. And, you know, I did it in the wrong way. That is a regret of mine. Obviously, things on the ice, you know, a lot of people don't understand that don't play happen in the bat of an eyelash. You know, you make some decisions that you're not sure about, but in the moment, it kind of just goes down the way it goes down because things happen so, so incredibly fast. Of course, all those suspensions and all those mistakes I made, I completely regret. But at the end of the day, fighting that adversity made me who I am today.
You know, you talk about things happening in a bat of an eyelash, and sitting in the stands or the press box for that matter, people can make a lot of assumptions, what they think they saw or what the motivation was for something happening. And that happened to you, right? Like people thought someone had said something to you and you don't shake the guy's hand and it was about something else. And you say, listen, it wasn't about that.
Couch coaching, I call it. Everybody thinks they're the head coach when they're sitting on their sofas watching the game. But for me, there was tons of speculation and people just thought they knew exactly what was going on. In fact, when they didn't. So that was very frustrating for me, just having to, you know, I would try to shrug it off, but obviously it was just, you know, an immense amount of pressure for me to come back and perform and the things people were saying about me. And, you know, I just felt an urge to just continue that ambitious feel and prove these people wrong.
Yeah, let's talk about a specific incident that happens when Colorado makes the playoffs again. Things get complicated, I think, is perhaps the, maybe not the right words, but I'll put it as complicated. Game 3 of the second round against the Blues, you're involved in a collision with goalie Jordan Binnington. He gets a lower body injury, sits out the rest of the series. You said all along, it's an accident. Then you get the target of racist and Islamophobic attacks online. They're never nice. Some were particularly harsh and awful, profane and violent. Things even were referred to the police. And Nazem Kadri, you say this completely changed your mindset. How so?
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly a delicate topic and, you know, over something that I had zero control of. In sports, things happen quickly and you just have to react as it is. So, you know, for me, that was the worst messages and, you know, in terms of the hate and the racism. I mean, I think that got to its peak at that point, you know, when I started to worry not only for myself and my own safety, but for my family's as well. So, you know, that's a tough predicament to be in when you have to, you know, perform at an NHL stage in the playoffs and worry about your family's safety at the same time. So, but for me, that really was a turning point in my career where, you know, I was able to put one foot in front of the other and just silence everybody, which was a nice feeling to have.
Mm-hmm. And how'd you do that? And what I mean by that is, like, it doesn't matter if you're an NHL player or a kid on a playground, like, that stuff hurts. It's maddening and saddening and scary. So how were you as a person, as I'm able to just be like, one foot in front of another, one foot in front of another?
Yeah, I mean, just conversations with my family and, you know, with myself. Honestly, it's when you're reading the type of stuff I had to read that people were saying about you, you know, that was just basically faith related and appearance related. You know, it kind of wore on me for a little bit, you know, and I'm not a person to really feel an immense amount of doubt all the time. I usually can battle through that pretty easily. But, you know, this was different. This was very hard for me. You know, I remember when it happened, I just, you know, I was down on myself for that entire night. I had a half decent sleep and woke up in the morning with just an absolute revengeful mindset where everybody was going to get it, you know, that next day on the ice. So, you know, it was hard for me to go through. But like I said, this ultimately, these are the type of situations that have, you know, have turned me into who I've become.
You also had a young baby at the time.
I did.
So that must, like when you looked at her, thought about what you were going through, I imagine that had some effect too.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you think about your family, that comes before hockey. You know, one of the things that hurt me the most was potentially worrying about their safety. And, you know, because I had been on the road at the time, so I wasn't at home. You know, I couldn't protect them in any way, shape or form. So that was very difficult to deal with. But at the end of the day, you know, I had a job to do and boy, did I do it.
That's one way of putting it, some redemption, your team, for those who don't remember or don't know. Colorado makes it to the finals. Game four goes into overtime, and then this happened.
Kadri back in action, denied by Vasilevsky. Oh, what a play!
It's in.
And it's in, or is it? Where is it? Does Vasilevsky have it?
No, it's in. It's in the back of the net.
And yes, it is a Nazem Kadri game-winning goal. And the Colorado Avalanche are on the cusp of the cup.
There you have it, right? Score the winning goal during overtime in game four. It doesn't get much better than that. You go on with your team to win the Stanley Cup after six games. So take me there, Nazem, especially given what you just said. Look, I was ready to get on that ice and just give it all there, but I'm worried about my family. What did that victory mean to you? Obviously, as a hockey player, but even beyond just winning the Stanley Cup, which in itself is awesome, I imagine.
Just listening to that clip in the final, scoring against Tampa Bay in a Stanley Cup final overtime game was something you just dream about. And, you know, it gives me goosebumps always hearing those clips because, you know, it's a bit of a controversial goal and just how it kind of tucked in to the back of the net and just kind of stayed there was very surreal. And not to mention I'd had surgery 2 weeks before that. That was my first game returning. Basically did that with one broken hand. So the stars aligned that year and just I had such an incredible group of teammates and support staff that I could have, you know, never done any of that without.
It was such a symbolic win, Nazem. I think for so many Canadians to see you, a Muslim Canadian, the first Muslim player to win the Stanley Cup, they saw a little bit of themselves in you. What was that like for you to know that they were seeing that?
Yeah, incredibly inspiring. And, you know, I think you don't really realize, you know, how much support and how much following you have in real time. I think afterwards, reflecting on it, you know, you start to realize people look up to you. And you know, for me, I'm certainly far from perfect, but, you know, I try to be the best, you know, role model as possible and try to give kids some hope. And, you know, because hockey is such a great sport. It is such a great game and you meet so many great people and just the camaraderie of it is just, you know, I can't speak enough about. So, you know, for me, it's an absolute privilege to just even be given that position and try to lead the way.
Yeah. I remember, I think it was the following summer, that the Stanley Cup goes back to London, Ontario, and into the mosque there. The first time the Stanley Cup has ever been inside a Muslim house of worship. That must have been quite something.
It definitely was. That's one way to put it, for sure. For me, I think anytime you can become the first person in history to accomplish something, I'm extremely proud of that. And, you know, like I said, it's, you know, opening the eyes up of the next generation. And, you know, this sport is going to be here. It was here long before me and it's going to be here long after me. So I just try to, lead by example and hopefully, you know, inspire some kids to you know, follow in my footsteps.
We started out talking about your dad, Samir. And I want to end our conversation talking about him as well, because you tell this great story about him rushing down the highway in his car one night when a song comes on the radio. You want to tell us that story?
That's actually a fantastic story. Yes, so my mom was giving birth to me, and my father was on his way to the hospital. He's rushing to the hospital, and right before he pulls in, The Big Leagues by Tom Cochran comes on the radio, and it says, my boy's going to play in the big leagues. And sure enough, that's kind of what happened. And ironically enough, I've actually become friends with Tom Cochran. I've told him that story a bunch, and he absolutely loves it. So it's really a full circle moment and an incredible story that, you know, my dad definitely loves to tell.
I was going to say, he must run around telling this story. I knew that my boy was going to make it. He must be pretty darn proud of you.
Yeah, he's definitely a proud dad when he gets the opportunity to play that story. But you know what? It's certainly a story worth telling. So it's a good one.
It's been nice to read about your life story, both on and off the ice, Nazem, and I appreciate you joining me. Thank you.
Okay, anytime. Thank you.
Nazem Kadri's new memoir is called Dreamer, My Life on the Edge. This is the Sunday Magazine. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. It is 1 month, less a day, until Americans choose their next president. And as that campaign goes on, every candidate's move, every word is being scrutinized. Derek Guy thinks there's another key aspect we shouldn't overlook when sizing up the contenders. Derek is a menswear writer who says politicians have always sent messages with their wardrobe choices, and what they wear has changed a ton over time.
The death of a suit starting in the post-war period meant that more Americans were dressing down, which forced many politicians to also kind of have to straddle this line on how do I look more relatable to the public, but also look like someone who deserves your vote, someone who can lead the country. Starting, I would say, like maybe in the 1970s, with President Carter out on the campaign trail wearing just a dress shirt and a tie. He doesn't have a jacket. And that's because he's around other people who are more casually dressed. And he doesn't want to look like Nixon. He doesn't want to look like part of the establishment. And this continues through the 80s and 90s. You see Reagan, for example, sometimes campaigning in cowboy gear. Bill Clinton continuing with the Carter tradition of just wearing a shirt and tie, no jacket. During the Obama years, he commonly campaigned with no tie, just a dress shirt. The tech boom and the rise of tech billionaires really put the final nail in the coffin for the suit. Figures like Mark Zuckerberg, for example, made hoodies and jeans not just an alternative for wearing suits to the office, but he made hoodies and jeans a new status symbol. The hoodie and jeans uniform said, I only care about meritocracy. I don't care about these formalities. I'm this kind of like hacker whiz kid who's creating the new economy, and I stand opposed to the traditional kind of suit and tie aesthetic. And even in traditional industries such as finance, law, government, you see more and more people dressing down. In 2019, Goldman Sachs sent out a memo to their employees saying that it was now fine to dress however you wanted the office, but you just had to look quote unquote professional. In the most high profile case in very recent times, Tim Walz, when he was first really kind of appearing on the national stage, was wearing Carhartts, barn coats, Filson jackets, and then he's made this kind of like camo cap part of his campaign. And I think this is one of those very interesting moments where someone has not only abandoned the tailored jacket, not only the tie, not only the dress shirt, but has put on workwear. And I think that's notable because it's the most dressed down version we've seen of a major politician. And it in some ways bolsters his brand as this kind of like everyday Midwestern guy. When Harris announced that Tim Walz would be her running mate, and then they released a video.
Hi, this is Tim.
It's Kamala Harris. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning, Madam Vice President.
Listen, I want you to do this with me. Let's do this together. Would you be my running mate and let's get this thing on the road?
I would be honored, Madam Vice President.
But what was interesting about the video is that Harris was in a suit and Walz was in a t-shirt. He might have been in work pants. I think he might have been wearing boots or sneakers or something. He was very dressed down. He was wearing a cap. And I think the campaign knew that they wanted to present Walz in this light to show him as a more relatable person. And even though I don't write about women's wear, I'm not sure that you could switch those positions. When Joe Biden selected Harris to be his running mate, I'm not sure they could have filmed a video showing Biden in a suit and Harris in whatever she wears to clean her garage. To me, that's one of these like disparities in how we think of what clothes communicate when they're worn by different people.
And we will make America great again. Thank you, Ohio.
Within the context of how politicians have always dressed down, Donald Trump never dresses down. There are a few photos of him like way back in the past that you can find of him wearing a flannel shirt and a pair of jeans. It's like a rare photo for a man who has been heavily photographed for his entire life. But the only time you really see him dressed down is when he's on the golf course. But in public life, he always wears not only a dark worsted suit, but a navy suit, a white shirt, always solid white, never striped, and then typically, although not always, a bright red satin tie. In the last 20 years, tailoring has become much softer to communicate a more casual, relaxed silhouette. The idea is to look a little bit more casual, a little bit more natural in your clothing as Americans dress down. And the interesting thing about Trump's suits is that they're heavily padded in the shoulders. He wears the aesthetic as a way to bolster his brand as a very successful businessman. He's trying to look a little bit more authoritative to give the impression of a more muscular kind of figure underneath. Whether people think that that ends up looking oversized or not is up for judgment, but there is a reason why he wears heavily padded shoulders, and it's to create a more imposing, authoritative, kind of classic V-shaped silhouette that you'd associate with masculinity. J.D. Vance himself, he has essentially reformed his image as he's become more of a Trumper. So when he was still working in tech, he declared himself as a never Trumper. He wore slim shorts, gray sport coats, sneakers, jeans. He typically didn't really wear a tie. He kind of conformed to that industry, essentially. And then over time, as he became more of a Trump supporter, you see his style slowly evolve to the kind of more padded jacket, slightly larger fit, solid white shirt, and again, a bright red tie. And I think it just demonstrates how Trumpism has not only affected our politics, but also how people communicate their politics and their identity through their clothes. I think when people hear any topic on fashion, they automatically dismiss it. And that's partly because history has been historically coded as frivolous and feminine. And there's such kind of disrespect for this field in a way that I don't think other areas get, especially areas that are coded as masculine, such as architecture or sports. But really, fashion doesn't have to just be about trends and runways and expensive like Gucci bags. It's really a reflection of culture. Clothes are essentially tied into every single human story because humans wear clothes. And the ways that they wear clothes, the way they style clothes, the way they express themselves are clothes, are so tied into other aspects of their life, including gender, sexuality, race, culture, how they interact with the world. And when you think of clothes in that way, I think it becomes much more interesting and also relevant to your life.
Derek Guy is a menswear writer. Let's go back to that day, October the 7th, 2023. In the early morning hours, Hamas entered Israel, killing 1,200 people and taking 250 others hostage, including about 100 who are still being held. One of the sites the militant group targeted was in the Negev Desert, about 5 kilometers from Gaza. 3,500 people, mostly young adults, were at the Supernova Music Festival. But the celebration of music turned into a massacre. 364 people were killed. Dean Tesler, was working at the festival as a security guard. Dean's currently in Toronto, and I spoke with him at the Beth Torah Synagogue a few days ago. So on October 7th of last year, you're at the Supernova Festival. You're working there as a security guard. You're with your best friend, a guy named Barr. We've all seen photos and videos from that festival, young people smiling, dancing, having a good night out. And then, of course, things change. What was the moment for you, Dean, that you knew, something's wrong here?
With the rockets in the sky in 6:30, we told the people leave. That moment, me and my best friend, Bob, we opened emergency exit. We saw a lady that she get out from the car, and she was bleeding from the head. For us, from that second, we start to thinking, why is she bleeding? Because it's only rockets, you know, we're used to it in Israel, fortunately. We take her to the paramedic, to the ambulance, and the moment when we, you know, put her in the ambulance, she just looked at us and told us the terrorists attacked her. And every car that came, they just shoot on the car. You probably saw videos. And after that, the paramedic told me and my friend, you have a lot of injured people. You need to go and take care. And this is what we're trying to do. They're just trying to help them because, I don't know, it's what we feel. We need to do that, you know?
After this woman, after you get her in an ambulance, you and a group of people run for your lives, basically, right? You flee to the woods, you run from place to place. There's a lot of chaos around. Some people are killed. And you eventually find a cactus, a bush, and you hide there for 8 hours. I'm sure that must have felt like a lifetime, those 8 hours.
I feel like 9 years, actually, you know, not 9 hours, like 9 years. Every second, feel decades, you know.
What are you thinking? Do you remember?
Of course. So when 10:30, I jump to the bush after I'm running with a group in the open field in the woods. After I saw them get murdered by the terrorist, and I just jumped to the bush and I told myself, what the chance the terrorist will get into a cactus? And then I started to send many locations to many friends. Honestly, I was crying inside of the bush. One of my best friends, he get the messages. He get the message, I'm going to die. He get the messages that, goodbye messages. And they, the friends, all the time just told me, the police will come, the help will come, just be strong. And 2:24, my phone batteries died.
Huh.
And I can tell you from that minute, every second you feel, it's a lot. And it's honestly just was between me and God from that second. Since 2:24 until around almost 8 p.m. till I rescued. And inside of these hours also, I accept my death. I really understand with myself that I'm going to die in the day. When the terrorists, 3 terrorists come into my bush and they just passed next to me, they didn't saw me. That moment, I just closed my eyes and waited for the moment they're going to kill me. Thank you, God, they didn't see me. They just pass. From there, just only to talk with God and, I don't know, for mercy or for help. Because I don't have with who to talk except only God, you know.
And then you feel safe enough, I guess, to...
Not exactly. Start to be dark. I'm after 9 hours in the bush. I cannot wait anymore. I tell myself I prefer to run away from the bush. And it's still shooting around. But I tell myself that I cannot wait anymore for the help. So we start running. And after 30, 40 minutes of running, I saw lights from the car. Then I tell myself it's kind of 50-50. Or it's the terrorist or it's the IDF. And thank you, God. They answer to me, it's the IDF, it's the IDF. I scream, I'm a survivor from the Nova, security guard from the Nova. After they give me water, charge my phone, calling my parents, tell my mom and dad, mom, I'm alive. I was screaming at the phone. And, you know, she just many hours waiting in the hospital when all of the bodies just coming. And a lot of hours that my parents don't know what is going on with me. And then I got a call from Bob's brother, my best friend.
Who was with you at the festival?
He worked with me. We come into best friend from Holon in Israel. We're going up, we grow up together. And then I got a video from his little brother that he sent me the video that Hamas posted in the morning. And then I realized that my best friend is a hostage.
He's still being held.
And he's still a hostage, yeah. Till today. Almost 1 year.
At that festival, 364 people lost their lives. 40, including your friend Barr, were taken hostage. People you knew, some you didn't, strangers, people you care for, but you survived.
Yeah. Survivor from the Nova. Kind of story of my life right now, you know.
And how does that sit with you? Because I could sit here and say, like, and you are. You're so lucky to be alive. But that's very simple.
So I was to be a survivor. So, of course, I live my life in a different way than before October 7th. I'll give you an example. First, and the most important for me, that I more appreciate my life right now. Because I'm already accept my death. So for me, as every day to be exist in this world is a huge gift. And people forget it, honestly. All of the world people forget it. And more than that, I get closer to the faith and get closer to God, and I more believe in God. But with all of that, of course, I'm living my life in a way that you, inside yourself, you know that no one can understand you. And why? Because something that happened to me, it not need to happen to no one, especially not to 21, 22 years old. And it's a feeling that, you know, I'm trying to build myself again. I'm trying to healing also. It's not easy, you know, I'm looking nice guy, but it's not easy to be with me every day.
And when you say no one really knows, there's only the survivors of that day that really know. It must be incredibly lonely.
Yeah, every day you feel lonely. You know, in my case, it's special because at the Nova, you have a bunch of people that came with 10 friends, one or two or three or four, you know, murder. But in my case, I came to the Nova only with one friend to be a security guard. And unfortunately, still a hostage. And when I around more survivors, of course, it's make feel great and good because you with people that kind of in the same boat like you. But honestly, deep in myself, I don't really feel connected and I don't feel really a part of the community. Of course, they love, of course, they support, of course, you know, good friends. But in my case, it's I come with one friend and he's not here as a hostage. And it's every day with me, every day in this last year that I'm survived and he's not and he held hostage and just believe that he soon will come back. And when he will come back, I can tell you that the trauma of October 7 honestly will be behind me. I believe that with the moment that Bob will come back home, I can say that October 7 is behind me.
You said to me, it's important for me to go tell my story. Why?
That's a healing for me. In Israel, you have a lot of people with PTSD, obviously, making sense. And after October 7, when I started to do the speeches, I understand with myself, it's really good for me to speak. And something that I learned, after trauma, the right thing to do for yourself is to speak about the trauma and not to let it get in and get in deeply, because then when you will try to heal, it will be much harder and difficult. So for me, I kind of found my purpose, my mission. With that, I'm the voice also of my best friend. In my opinion, everyone needs to know who exactly is Bar Cooperstein, a 22 years old guy that was at the Nova, saved a lot of people, take care of a lot of people, and he taken hostage when he tried to help the others. So if I do it for myself, my healing, if it's to be the voice also for more survivors that their situation is not, I can say, not good like mine, I can say, and if it's to my friend at hostage, that he cannot be here right now because he's in Gaza somewhere. I wish that all of the survivors will do kind of the same and just speak about their trauma. And today, a year after, I can tell you I'm stronger, I'm more believe. I'm in a really good step-by-step in this year, I can tell you. I want to keep doing what I'm doing. And my opinion, it's everyone need to know.
You're young.
22. Young, but not young. You know. Mm-hmm.
How do you think of the future?
My future? If it's maybe to be, I don't know, speaker for my country, if it's to be a politic, something, I really don't know. But I want to help to people. I want to, if it's to be a mentor or if it's to be anything that can help to this world, I think. And, you know, I want to keep living in a peace way. I don't want to see wars, you know, Israel, Palestine, Russia, Ukraine, my mom from Ukraine. So Ukraine is kind of my second country. So both of my countries in a war right now. I just wanted all of the world would be a better place for everyone. You know, too much crazy thing happened in my life. And I want a better life, of course.
I'm glad you're doing well. And I hope you get to see your friend Bar again.
Thank you, Bezrat Hashem. Soon.
Dean Tesler is a survivor of the October 7th attack. Israel was forever changed on October the 7th, and soon, too, was the Gaza Strip. Day after day for the past year, Gaza has been hit by Israeli airstrikes, and it goes on. People have been told to flee and forced to flee within the small territory. The Gaza Health Ministry says more than 41,000 people have been killed and 96,000 injured. 90% of Gaza's 2.3 million people have been displaced at least once, according to the United Nations. Frida Al-Hul has moved several times. She's an English teacher and interpreter who had been living in Gaza City in the north on October the 7th. She fled with her younger brothers and members of her extended family when things became too unsafe. Farida's now at a makeshift encampment in Deir al-Bala, that's in central Gaza. And we recently reached her there.
Before 7th of October, life was already tough, but there was still some semblance of stability. I was teaching, organizing activities for my students, trying to make a positive impact. We had a great life, wallah. We have a great life, but everything changed drastically. We lost our home, our neighborhood. We were suddenly living in complete chaos. Destroyed my hopes, my dreams, my entire life. With no safe place to go. The fear and uncertainty we now face are unimaginable, unbearable.
Unbearable for Farida means daily challenges of life during wartime that she says keep her in survival mode, from bombings to the elements.
Every day starts with uncertainty, starts with pumpings, where the sound of distant or nearby pumpings often fills the air. You know what's the biggest challenging and the greatest fear in Gaza now is the rain. You know why? Because children who sleep without anything to keep them warm. This is the most challenges we are facing now. I've lost a lot of family members. To be honest, everything here is very, very tough. We are facing the most difficult circumstances can the human in this world endure. I'm so speechless in the whole scenes I've been experiencing and this year. No human in this world, absolutely no human in this world can endure a little bit of what are we facing every day in Gaza.
Soon after October the 7th, Farida made the tough choice to leave her parents in the north of the Gaza Strip while she fled south to Rafah with her younger brothers and nephews, hoping to give them a better chance of survival.
My parents asked us to leave, to go to the south to save our life. And my nephews were so afraid. Because the pumps, the hunger, because the lack of basic necessities, because of that, we evacuated to the south and leave the rest of my family in the north.
Leaving her parents behind is one of the hardest decisions Farida's made, and one she says she regrets.
Yeah, I'm so regret to leave them and to separate from them. It was the hardest decision I have made in my life. If I have the last breath of my life and just want to achieve something in this life, just to see my parents, I really miss them. I really need to hug them. I cannot imagine I will miss them like this. It's very harsh to be in the same land, but you cannot see them. You cannot see the closest people to you. This is so heartbreaking. This is so, so difficult to spend 1 year without seeing their smiles, their faces, to hear their voices. This is so tough. You cannot imagine how did I spend this year without them. It was not easy. It was not easy.
Being constantly on the move over the past year has also not been easy. Farida says she has lost count of the number of evacuation orders that have prompted her to flee.
Oh, I couldn't count how multiple times I evacuated from a place to place with my nephews and with my little brother Adel. We have moved multiple times, just trying to find safety. Our tough journey has been exhausting and terrifying. We have walked destroyed streets, seeing people who have lost everything, seeing our martyrs on the street, but we cannot hold them or help them or make anything to them. There is destruction everywhere also. Homes, schools, hospital, all turned to rubble. The constant sound of drones and the bombs overhead only adds to the horror.
Amid the horror that Farida describes, it's hard to imagine what the future holds, to even think about what's next. But her work as a teacher gives Farida some hope.
In Gaza, we don't look for the next year. We just look for the next second, because at any moment we lose our life. We cannot think of our futures. For example, like some people, and before the war, I heard them, what's your decisions for the next 5 years? We cannot know what's the next after 1 second. I don't know what's the next step on my future. But I'm trying to continue here in the South my work because I want to keep supporting my students, my people here, to make something in this life, helping people here learn despite the circumstances. This is get me some positive energy and get me a hope to rebuild my life. Find some stability and continue to be a voice of those who cannot speak for themselves.
And with her voice, Farida wants to send a message to the world.
Don't leave us alone. You are the only hope. To be honest, I really miss the peace. I want us to live in peace without war. And my greatest hope is that our voices will be heard. This is what I need from the world, and what I miss for the war is just some peace.
Farida Al-Hul is an English teacher and interpreter. We recently reached her at an encampment in Deir al-Balah in the Gaza Strip. This is the Sunday Magazine. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and today we're taking stock of 1 year since the Israel-Hamas war began and what the future may hold. Gideon Levy started his day on October the 7th with a jog through a park near his home in Tel Aviv. The Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz newspaper was struggling to think of a subject to cover for his next column. But that all changed when the park filled with the piercing sounds of air raid sirens. Ever since, Gideon has not struggled with any writer's block. The longtime critic of Benjamin Netanyahu's government has become one of Israel's most prominent voices to oppose the war with Hamas, and it has made Gideon a controversial figure. His new book is called The Killing of Gaza, Reports on a Catastrophe. Gideon Levy, hello to you.
Thank you, Pia, for having me, and hello to you.
Let's start with the headline of your first column following October 7th. This is 2 days after the Hamas attack. The headline read, Israel can't imprison 2 million Gazans without paying a cruel price. Gideon, people were still digesting what had happened on October the 7th. So what was going through your mind as you wrote that piece?
I couldn't forget, even in this horrible day, that there is a context to everything. I mean, the feeling of most of the Israelis that this came to us out of the blue sky as if there is no context. I didn't share this. I knew all the time that people who live for 18 years in a cage might do terrible things. And they have done terrible things. And nobody intends to justify what they have done. But not to understand the context, not to realize the roots of this terrible hatred and violence, this for me was too much.
You then, Gideon, as journalists do, travel down to the south of Israel, particularly to the towns of Sderot. It's about a kilometer or two from the border with Gaza, and Be'eri. And you see what has happened to the people in those communities firsthand. The death, the destruction, the devastation. And you take that in. You bear witness. How did your perspective change at that point?
It was Monday, 48 hours after it all happened. I saw scenes that I've never seen throughout all my years covering wars and Israeli occupation. And I saw really horrible scenes, but basically didn't change anything in my belief that as long as Israel will continue to think that it's only about living on the sword and only by military force and only by oppressing other people, there will be a solution. No, even in those vis-a-vis those horrible scenes in Be'eri, in Sderot, in Erod, I thought that it will never be solved without a political solution.
And when you in those early days, Gideon, said that to your fellow Israelis who were in shock, who were mourning, as you were also mourning, what would they say to you?
I lost them. In many ways, I lost a part of my friends and many of my readers. Because something happened in Israel after the 7th of October, namely that Israelis came to the conclusion, all of them, by the way, almost all of them, that after the 7th of October, we have no interest in the Palestinians, we have no empathy to any Palestinians. And the second conclusion of all Israelis, I would say, was that after the 7th of October, Israel has the right to do whatever it wants. I couldn't share both, and not sharing this made me quite isolated, I must say, like never before. The 7th of October was horrible, but it doesn't mean that we should lose any empathy or humanity toward the endless Palestinian victims in Gaza.
When you were in Be'eri, you saw Israeli reservists gathered there amid the ruins. The government had called up hundreds of thousands of young Israelis who were conscripted into the military to fight its war in Gaza. But when you first go to Be'eri and you see the soldiers, you once served in the Israeli Defense Forces, the military, the IDF. What were your thoughts as you watched those young soldiers on that day?
I thought that here they are sent again to an impossible mission. I thought how many of them will not return. I thought about their parents, about them, about their friends. I thought how brainwashed we all are that we follow the same mistakes again and again, namely that we always have to take revenge and always have to punish, and that only the language of force can bring us to any kind of solution. I felt terrible about those young people, as I feel now. My nephew is now in the Lebanese border, and he's all devoted for his service, and good for him. But shall I tell you that I think that it's very clever now to start another war also with Lebanon with the same method? Not at all. Shall I tell you that both wars are inevitable? Sure, they could be prevented, or at least challenged. But Israel always chose the war as the first solution.
A few days after October 7th, when you put your pen to paper once again, as you do as a columnist, you wrote, quote, "The emotional turmoil is, of course, understandable, but not the totalitarianism that has followed in its wake." What did you mean by that, Gideon?
This total thinking that it's either us or them. That's the main mindset now in Israel, either us or them. And it will never be either us or them. It will be both of us. It just depends on which terms. But it will never be either us or them. But if you ask any average Israeli, and that's the totalitarian thought, either us or them. What does it mean, either us or them? What will happen to them exactly?
And many Israelis, Gideon, would argue that the war is necessary because the us and them is a fight, people in Israel would argue, is an existential one, the existence of the Jewish state, the survival of the Jewish state. And many Israelis argue that the war is necessary for the security of the Israeli people. So what's your argument? How can Israel maintain its own security without severely weakening Hamas?
So first of all, Pia, let's ask ourselves, after 1 year of terrible fighting in Gaza, of over 40,000 people killed, most of them civilians, of hundreds of Israeli soldiers who were killed, is Israel a more secure place to be? Is Israel in a better place than it was before the war? What did Israel gain exactly from this war? Let's say that the war is totally justified and even legitimate, and Israel has the most moral arm in the world, which it does. But in terms of interest, what did we gain out of this war exactly? Hamas is life and kicking. The hostages were not released. Israel is turning into a pariah state all over the world. What did Israel gain out of this justified, inevitable war? Nothing. We are in a much worse position than we were on the 6th of October.
Gideon, you're a very polarizing person in your country and abroad. There are people who hear you and think, yep, he's got it right. You're beloved by them. And then there are people who call you a traitor. They hate you. They listen to you and they say you're totally wrong and that you don't care about Israel. You've received death threats. You say, as you said to me, I've lost so many people who are close to me. They've abandoned you as you express your views. What drives you to continue writing and speaking out?
I cannot stop. I mean, I might be stopped by the government, by Haaretz, who will decide to fire me, by I don't know what, by violence. But otherwise, this is what I thought is important for me to do. And this is what I'm trying to do with very little success, if at all, but with the same deep devotion that someone has to raise those questions and someone has to hold this mirror, even if it's very, very unpleasant to many, many, many Israelis.
Why do you think that many, many, as you just said, Israelis, I don't know, I think you would argue don't get it or don't share your views. What do you think is behind that?
It's quite simple. You cannot maintain an oppression of another people, such a brutal occupation like the Israeli one. You have to create yourself a whole set of beliefs which will justify your behavior. You have to convince yourself that the Palestinians are not human beings like you, because otherwise you will not live in peace with what you are doing to them. So let's believe that they are not human beings like us. Let's believe they were born to kill. Let's believe that they are all cruel enemies. Then it will be much easier to live in peace with the reality. So for most of the Israelis, I am disturbing this very delicate balance in which they don't know and they don't want to know and they don't want to hear and they don't want to be asked all kinds of questions. For me, who try to whistle in the darkness and just to tell the stories that are not told here, immediately the reaction is aggressive, because that's the way, the only way to cope with it. What shall they say after killing 41,000 people? I mean, you can't find any moral justification for this.
The alternative to this is a political solution. There, of course, are those who argue de-escalation through escalation, that the war is necessary. There needs to be retaliation for October 7th, that Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran's proxies need to be hit very hard. Then there's the other solution, and that's a political one, which much of the Western world is calling for and other states, and that is the two-state solution. And you, Gideon Levy, write that the two-state solution is dead. Who killed it?
The Jewish settlers, 700,000 of them, who took over the West Bank and didn't leave any room for any kind of viable Palestinian state, as simple as this. I'm very much in favor of the two-state solution. It's the most just solution. Two peoples are struggling over one piece of land. Let's share it. But 700,000 settlers, part of them very violent, with the support of Israel's establishment, defense forces, and public opinion, they changed the map. And without their evacuation, there is no viable Palestinian state. And I don't see anyone being able to evacuate the most powerful political group, pressure group in Israel. So without their evacuation, there is no viable Palestinian state. In other words, there is no political solution, or at least not the two-state solution. Very bad for all of us, but those who support the two-state solutions should have thought about it much before they supported the sending of hundreds of thousands of Jews to the West Bank in order to prevent the two-state solution, because they went there in order to prevent any chance for a Palestinian state, and they succeeded.
So now what, Gideon? If you, as you do, make the argument that war is not the answer, and if you, as you do, make the argument that the two-state solution has no viability, that there's no lift left in that possibility, then what? Now what?
First of all, Pia, in many ways, I'm not responsible to all the mistakes that were done in the last decades. Now to come and ask me what is your solution, my solution was there 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when it was still achievable. Now it's not. But still, at least there is a vision. We are living for over 50 years now in a one state. Jenin and Hebron, in many ways also Gaza, are governed by the Israeli army and the Israeli government, exactly like me in Tel Aviv and people of Jerusalem or Haifa. We are all under the same sovereignty of the government of Israel. We are living in one state.
And Gideon, just for people who aren't as familiar with the region as you are, the argument you're making there is that places like Hebron and Jenin in the West Bank, Israel military occupies the West Bank. People's freedom of movement can be decided by soldiers on the ground. And in Gaza, your argument is that Israel controls the borders, air, land and sea into Gaza.
Absolutely. Perfectly. They all are living under Israeli government or Israeli control.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has for the past year said that this is a fight for Israel's survival. Others say it is a fight for his political survival. Many Israelis and people around the world believe that the government of Israel needs to change, that it is a singular challenge with this prime minister and some others in his coalition government. To what extent do you think change in the political landscape may make change on the ground, so to speak?
Much less than it seems, and much less than those protesters are describing it. Netanyahu should go. His government is horrible. It's a real fascist government. But all the potential candidates to replace him will do the same policy, will implement the same policy when it comes to continuing the occupation, when it comes to continuing those two wars, or maybe three until then, with Hezbollah, with Hamas, and God forbid also with Iran. None of them is in favor of stopping those wars. None of them is ready to enable a Palestinian state. None of them sees the Palestinians as equal human beings. So by and large, this hatred toward Netanyahu, which is justified, but behind this, beyond this, there is no hope for a real change, because there will be changes, obviously, in terms of domestic politics, corruption, capability to govern. There will be many, many changes for the good if this government will go home. One thing will not change. Israel will continue to be an occupier, and Israel will continue with its endless wars. This will not change.
Given all that you've said, your perspective on this, your views on this, what do you want to say to the world 1 year after October 7th and to your fellow Israelis?
I want to say that the 7th of October was horrible, and I was witnessing a small part of it in my tours in the South. By the way, last week I went there again, and things seem as terrible as they seemed to me 1 year ago. The destruction is still there. The burnt houses that I visited 1 year ago are still standing there, and the shock and the trauma and the loss of so many lives is still obviously there. And it was a horrible thing. But the question is, was it necessary to go for such a big scale war against Gaza, knowing that it might complicate Israel in a regional war, knowing that tens of thousands of Palestinians will pay in their lives for this war? Where does it lead us?
Gideon Levy, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Gideon Levy is an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz. His latest book is called The Killing of Gaza. You're listening to The Sunday Magazine. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Hamas was founded back in 1987, and in 2002, Canada listed it as a terrorist group, a designation it still has today here and in many other Western countries. Beverly Milton Edwards is a senior non-resident fellow at the Middle East Center for Global Affairs in Qatar. She wrote a book called Hamas that has just been updated. Beverly, hello to you.
Hello, Pia. How are you?
I'm okay. Let us go back to 1 year ago today. So that would have been October the 6th, 2023. Hamas would have been in its, I imagine, its final planning stages for the attack it carried out the next day. But describe Hamas's role in Gaza October 6th and before that. What was it?
Hamas, I mean, its very roots when it was founded in 1987 lie in the Gaza Strip. That's where the movement was actually founded. And in the years between 1987 to October 6th last year, Hamas had sort of developed into a sort of number of forms and stages. So after the Palestinian elections of 2006, which Hamas won the majority in, Hamas had become a governing authority in Gaza. But at the same time, it also had maintained its position, as it refers to itself, an armed resistance movement. And that armed resistance movement is known as the Yazidine al-Qassam Brigades. Hamas, during the period and up to October the 6th last year, was experiencing a lot of pressure, the same kind of pressures that everybody, the 2.3 million Palestinians who live in Gaza, were experiencing. Much of that pressure came as a result of the legacy of the Hamas takeover of Gaza Strip from its Palestinian national opponents. That legacy included diplomatic isolation and an Israeli-imposed air, land, and sea blockade on the whole of the Gaza Strip. So this meant that there were rising rates of insecurity, a sort of ever-growing humanitarian crisis. And of course, during that period from 2008 to October the 6th last year, Hamas and Israel had variously clashed with each other, engaged in armed conflict with each other in 2008, 2012. 2014, 2018, 2021, and again earlier in 2023. And in those periods in between, Israel, Hamas, and the other Palestinian armed groups would try and reach forms of temporary ceasefire. So that's pretty much gives you a sort of overview of what was going on with the entirety of the Hamas movement before that fatal attack over the border.
You and your co-author, Stephen Farrell, wrote this book back in 2010, and then you updated it. Over those years, You know, you interviewed Hamas leaders. There are, of course, new leaders. But take us inside their thinking as best you can. What is your, I don't know, understanding of their goal in attacking Israel on October the 7th?
For Hamas and its leaders, October the 7th was the culmination of a number of strategic and tactical factors. At a strategic level, Hamas saw an accelerating marginalization of the issue of Palestinian rights, their right to self-determination and independence. And they'd seen that this issue was just being progressively pushed off the international agenda. They were also concerned by the processes of political normalization with Israel by a number of Arab states that no longer demanded that the Palestinian right of self-determination be part of those agreements. And as I've already said, Israel's siege on Gaza since 2007 was basically unabated. There was very little hope. And then looking at what was going on in the other Palestinian-occupied territories, in particular in East Jerusalem, what Hamas and its leadership were seeing were continuous and growing violations by extremist Israelis of Palestinian and Muslim holy places like Al-Aqsa in Jerusalem. And that these violations, violations of international law, rights to self-determination, freedom of worship, that these violations were taking place really without any kind of accountability according to international norms or international law, or even the sort of feelings and passions and rights of other supporters of the Palestinian people across the world.
Gaza is not unlike any other large group of people. And what I mean by that is there's a diversity of opinions and views and who politically backs whom, who supports what, who doesn't support what. But overall, Beverly, how much popular support was there in Gaza for this attack by Hamas?
Well, you're absolutely right to point out that among Palestinians in the occupied territories, there are sections and factions of support for different political groups. By and large, they normally break down between two groups, one of them being Hamas, the other being the PLO, and the main faction of that is called Fatah. Now, I think what's really interesting, if you look at the polls across the many decades that these two groups have been in existence, is that by and large, Hamas have emerged to enjoy more popularity among Palestinians than their opponents in the Fatah movement and the PLO. Since October the 8th, the war on Gaza, those levels of support have actually, up until the last month, stayed consistently higher for Hamas in terms of support for its war aims or the aims of its attack on October the 7th than they have done for the PLO and Fatah.
You listed the number of armed conflicts between Israel and Hamas over time, a lot of them. And each one of them prior to this one has ended in some kind of ceasefire, often impressed upon the parties, but agreed to by them in the end by the international community. And I bring those up, Beverly, because do you believe that Hamas, the leadership of Hamas, underestimated what Israel's response to October 7th would be? In other words, did they think like this is going to be the same as usual?
I think it can certainly be agreed that before October the 7th, both Hamas and the government of Israel had over the years come to, in military parlance, sort of reach a form of modus operandi, and that in particular that there were rules of the game, and that each party to this conflict was able to quite carefully and at a tactical level calibrate the amount of violence that they would inflict on the other in this rather sort of strange asymmetric conflict, with both sides actually ultimately seeking to deter through threat of terror and terrorism. I don't think anybody would have been able to predict the extent to which Israel has reacted to the events of October the 7th and the way in which they have done that, least of all Hamas.
Eliminating Hamas is one of Israel's key stated goals. Over the past year, it has targeted its leadership for assassination. Ismail Haniyeh, who was a longtime political leader of Hamas, was killed in Tehran a couple months back. Israel has not publicly acknowledged responsibility for it. Israel continues to go after other leaders of Hamas. Will cutting the head off of Hamas, so to speak, get the outcome Israel is hoping for?
I think that's debatable. And I mean, Israel have been killing and assassinating Hamas leaders since the early 1990s, around 1992. Those Hamas leaders have been political leaders. Sometimes those leaders have been mediators for ceasefires and peace. Sometimes those leaders have been avowed military commanders against Israel. Israel has attempted to kill or has killed Hamas leaders both in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, in Jordan, Beirut, and even abroad in places like the United Arab Emirates. So there's nothing new in this respect in terms of the tactics. In the past, the tactic of decapitation has not worked. Nevertheless, it's also true to say that the Hamas leadership has in no doubt been depleted by the events of the past year. But because of this history, this is also an organization that is well used to regrouping, rebuilding, and replenishing itself. For decades, the demise of Hamas has been declared, and indeed very few of the founding leaders of the organization have survived. But nevertheless, the organization itself has survived. So this is very frustrating to its enemies, its apparent ability to regenerate at will, whether it's in the top command and the leadership of the movement or among its many cadres and fighters. And we know already, for example, that in areas of northern Gaza, where Israel went in, fought the battle, degraded and destroyed all infrastructure, and claimed the scalps of Izzedine Al-Qassam Brigade fighters. Now that they've left these areas, Hamas have experienced a rush of new volunteers who are ready to engage in their, as they call it, their resistance against Israel and help their people to achieve independence and self-determination. And they do this willingly under the banner of Hamas.
I want to talk about Lebanon as well, of course, and Hezbollah, because that is the latest front that has been opened up in southern Beirut. Fighting goes on between Hezbollah and Israeli forces. The Lebanese militant group began firing thousands of rockets into Israel on October the 8th, the day after Hamas attacked. Tell me about the relationship between Hezbollah and Hamas today.
Sitting at the center of that relationship actually is Iran. Both Hamas and Hezbollah are parts of the Iranian-led axis of resistance. I mean, I'm sure your listeners will know that these groups are frequently called proxies of Iran. And therefore, that kind of leads us to think, oh, well, they must all be the same. They must be receiving their orders directly from Tehran. They must all be singing on the same hymn sheet. And this simply isn't the case. When Hamas undertook the attack on October the 7th, it did so without prior knowledge of Iran's leaders, and Hezbollah's attacks against Israel from southern Lebanon into Israel's northern areas has been seen as part of the tactical assault on Israel to create the kinds of pressures that would lead to weakness in Israel's military capacity to deal with the problems on its southern front.
And the so-called axis of resistance, the Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, Hamas, as this axis is often called by some people in the West, some leaders in the West, against Israel. How important are these groups to Iran in terms of it projecting its power in the Middle East, in terms of if Israel or when Israel decides to retaliate for the attacks on Israel just a few days ago?
All of these groups are important. And rather than seeing these groups as sort of one group or another group retaliating on behalf of Iran, we need to remember really that this is a very long and enduring cycle of tit-for-tat violence and conflict between Israel and these other actors. But certainly what we've seen since October the 7th last year, actually, is that some of these actors, for example, the Houthis, are often acting entirely autonomously from Tehran. Now, the reason why I say this is because overall, the Iranian leadership had actually developed an approach that was called strategic patience. What they wanted actually was de-escalation in the region, not escalation, and certainly not to have the region brought to the brink of all-out war, which is what we're currently looking at. But what we need to remember most of all is that this is and these are deliberate cycles of conflict and violence. And most important of all, we need to remember who's bearing the cost. And at a very human level, the very upsetting and disappointing thing about the escalation of conflict over the past year in the Middle East is that it's civilians, women and children in particular, who are bearing the biggest cost of all from this conflict.
We appreciate your analysis so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Beverly Milton Edwards is the co-author of the book Hamas. That's it for this week on the Sunday Magazine. Our team is Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andre Huang, Pete Mitten, Aronde Williams, and Lou Zhou. We had additional help this week from freelancer Mohammed El-Saif in Gaza. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you so very much for lending us your ear. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.